WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latte from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hello, New York. Hello, New Jersey. Hello, Connecticut. Hello, America. Hello, wherever you are. It is great to be back after visiting China for the first time in my life last week. I've definitely got stories to tell, which we will roll out in coming shows, beginning in about an hour when we talk about some Chinese people who explicitly argue that authoritarianism is better than democracy. You just don't hear that argument here. We talk about why China has authoritarianism, what we should do about it. But there are obviously people there who argue that it's better, and we will play some clips of one of the people who I met who actually makes that case explicitly, and he even lived in the United States and worked for Ross Perot for a number of years, so that's coming up. Thanks again to Heidi Moore, Anna Sale, Mike Pesca, and Amy Eddings for filling in while I was gone. Great job, all of you, from what I hear. And being immersed in China and international news while I was gone, we will take calls later in the show for you to fill me in on any hyperlocal news that you think I may have missed and need to know, and you can fill each other in at the same time. But in the meantime, I see that while I've been gone, the Washington scene has gotten wonkier and wonkier, with the fiscal cliff negotiations now getting to the nitty-gritty of what to do about the payroll tax, whether Obamacare counts as a tax that should be factored into the talks, and even the mixed metaphor warning that the fiscal cliff might collide with the next debt ceiling. I'm not sure how a cliff and a ceiling collide, but hey, anything's possible in our politics these days, right? NPR's Mara Liasson is here to talk about the latest in the negotiations. Hi, Mara.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for doing this. And let's start with the president's latest statement. Speaking to the Business Roundtable yesterday, he reiterated his stance on tax rates for the wealthy.
It is not possible for us to raise the amount of revenue that's required for a balanced package if all you're relying on is closing deductions and loopholes.
And, of course, the GOP plan so far does not include a tax rate hike for the wealthy. Republicans instead would try to raise revenue by changing deductions and loopholes. You heard the president say that wasn't enough. Mara, is there reliable math on whether you can raise enough money just by reforming the deductions and loopholes?
Well, there's no doubt that there's reliable math. If you're willing to get rid of deductions in a way that would get rid of some of the middle class's deductions, you can do it. If you're willing to get rid of, eliminate, or severely curtail the charitable giving deduction, you can do it. It's mathematically possible. The question is, what's politically possible? And if you want to hold harmless people who are earning $250,000 or less, it's very hard to do. The White House went to great pains yesterday to walk reporters through this and sent out a handout, said that if you want to cap deductions at $25,000, which is what Republicans have said, you're going to hit 17 million middle class people. Therefore, if you adjust for that, you don't get $800 billion in revenues anymore. You get less. If you also want to get rid of the want to keep the charitable giving deduction, you're going to get even less, something like $450 billion. And then they said there's a problem in how you implement it, because if you make $250,000 a year, you don't have your deductions capped. But if you make $251,000 a year, you all of a sudden get your deductions capped. It's very complicated.
Yeah. And the gulf between the two sides when it comes to the high-end tax rates is about 4.5 points. It's not like anyone is proposing to double taxes on the wealthy or anything. It's 35% versus 39.6%. Do you think ultimately there's just going to be a deal somewhere in that 4-point band?
Well, a lot of people think that they'll compromise at like 37. The president has certainly left that open. He's not adamantly insisting on going back to the Clinton tax rates. The problem for Republicans is they've already given on revenues. That was a big give for them. They said, okay, we will agree to raise $800 billion in new tax revenues, not just tax revenues that would be offset by tax cuts somewhere else. But where they're drawing the line is tax rates. And this is a matter of deep ideology for them. So it's going to be very hard for them to raise to vote for anything that raises tax rates in any way. That's going to be the biggest and probably final sticking point.
And earlier this week, the conservative policy analyst Jim Capretta said on our show that he thinks Republicans are going to have to cave on high-end rates, but that they'll do so by redrawing the cutoff line. So why is the line at $250,000 a year right now? And do you see it getting redrawn at perhaps $500,000 a year or even $1 million so that it targets just the 1% or the 0.5%, instead of the top 2 or 3% that extends down to $250,000? And that would be the nature of the compromise.
Well, that's been discussed as a possible compromise, that instead of 250, it would go up to 500 or a million. There are Democrats who've suggested that. The president's been asked about this, and he's never ruled it out. He's never ruled out compromising on the rate, and he's never ruled on compromising on the cutoff. What he has said as an absolute bottom line for him is that tax rates on upper-income people have to go up. And I think that in the end, he will get that. Now, he could get that in a number of different ways, some of them more productive than others. If you go over the fiscal cliff, that will happen. And it will also probably cause all sorts of other things. It'll also raise taxes on middle-class people. But yes, I think the bottom line is that rates on upper-income people are going up. What's defined as upper income remains to be seen, and exactly how much their rates are going to go up remains to be seen.
NPR's Mara Liasson, as we peer toward the fiscal cliff, which of course comes at the end of the month, and we're trying to get into some of the weeds here about the details, which are wonky but interesting. And we can take your calls for Mara for a few minutes at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. For everyone that seems wonky and abstract and remote to you, there's another listener out there for whom this is actually going to change their personal finances. So let's get to one of these things, Mara. As you know, the single largest item in the fiscal cliff is, as I'm seeing it, the pending expiration of the 2 percentage point cut in the payroll tax, the so-called payroll tax holiday that we've had that pertains to those Social Security and Medicare taxes, worth about $100 billion annually. Explain when the payroll tax holiday came into being, remind us, and what role it plays in these negotiations.
Well, it plays a role because, first of all, it was part of the last deal. The president wanted some kind of stimulus, and that's what he got. It expires like the extension of unemployment insurance, like the Bush tax cuts. It all expires at the end of this year. The president would like to continue it. The big question is whether he can get that in a final deal. For a while, the payroll tax cut had fallen out of favor because it does take money technically out of the Social Security Trust Fund. And some people don't like to see Social Security taxes as something that you should mess around with. But now it's coming back into favor as a badly needed stimulus for an economy that seems like it's softening again.
From a purely philosophical standpoint, wouldn't Republicans want to keep the payroll tax low and maybe eventually even eliminate it if it funds the Social Security program that they want to shrink anyway?
Not really, because that's not how they look at it. Social Security is something that the president has said in terms of changing it or changing the formula by which benefits are calculated should be handled separately. He doesn't mind talking about it at the same time as you talk about the fiscal cliff, but he wants it to be on a separate track. And Republicans do not want to do anything that would undermine the trust fund. They want to make Social Security solvent. I don't think they're looking for any way that they can cut or undermine Social Security.
And both plans include very vague language about reforms to deductions, but neither is specific. And both sides are pretty frank about saying, look, we'll pass the deal and then we'll let the tax wonks work it out. But don't we have a right to know, as the American people, what deductions are on the table and what aren't? If our home mortgage interest is going to be affected, if our charitables are going to be affected, if our income tax-free health benefits at work are going to be affected, any of those things, those are big stuff.
Well, it's all big stuff. Yes, but don't forget the way that people are talking about tax deductions are not going through the tax code and picking out individual deductions to eliminate or curtail. They're talking about a cap. This was the biggest intellectual contribution of Mitt Romney, by the way, who this was kind of his one big idea. He said that's what we should do. We should put a cap. He threw out a lot of different numbers, 17,000, 25, 50, some kind of hard cap on the amount of deductions you can take. President Obama has been specific. He has said he wants to cap deductions for high-income earners at 28%. In other words, instead of taking them at 35% or whatever your tax rate is, you could only take them at 28%. So he's put forward his idea. The Republicans have merely put forward a gross number, $800 billion of revenues that they say they can get from closing loopholes, but they haven't said what those loopholes are or what cap they would prefer.
I caught this headline on ABC the other day. Boehner wants Obamacare in fiscal cliff negotiations. And I guess Boehner wrote an op-ed in the Cincinnati Enquirer saying the Republicans should see Obamacare as a tax, a significant tax, and as such, it should be part of the push to lower taxes. Do you see that happening? Does this become a vehicle for putting Obamacare or repealing some aspect of Obamacare back on the table, back in play?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what he's referring to. There are many taxes in Obamacare, and maybe they would be on the table along with everything else. And for instance, if you changed some formulas for entitlements, maybe some Obamacare formulas would be changed as well in terms of how fast they would grow. But I don't see anything in the fiscal cliff negotiations that would undermine in a significant way the president's health care plan.
Let's take a phone call. Mike in Brooklyn, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Love your show.
Thank you. Thank you.
I mean, the reality is that $250,000 outside the New York City area is just straight rich. You know?
Yeah. So if they're going to let people between 250 and 500 off the hook, or between 250 and a million off the hook, outside of New York City, he says that's just straight rich. How would they react to that statement in Washington?
Well, it's really, I would say you'd have to draw your geographic boundary a lot bigger. New Jersey, Connecticut, there are a lot of suburbs around big cities where $250,000 doesn't feel super rich to people. And don't forget what happened a long time ago in New Jersey, where somebody defined, Governor Florio defined $70,000, I think it was, or $75,000 as upper income, and he had a complete revolt on his hands. So there are people, you know, Chuck Schumer at one point suggested that the limit be raised. Tim Kaine, the new incoming senator from Virginia, has suggested that maybe it'd be 500,000. But these are all things that will be played with in negotiations if we ever get any.
And that question of who's rich and who's not, and outside of New York City or the metro area or certain metro areas, I guess they never talk about indexing for cost of living, right? So that if you live in Manhattan and you make a certain amount of money, the cost of living is factored into what kind of income group your rate should be.
There is a form of that because your state and local taxes are deductible. So, and of course, that's one of those deductions. And that's really where this comes into play. If you live in a place where there's a high cost of living and you pay high state and local taxes, you do get to deduct those. And when you're talking about getting rid of deductions, that's where people in high cost of living areas get very nervous.
Bob in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello, Mara Liason.
Yes.
Hello? Yeah, you're driving me bananas here. The deductions also, I'm glad you pointed out the property taxes, also the state income taxes, state sales taxes, also medical expenses, anything out of your pocket, dental expenses, premiums on your own health insurance plan. But here's where I think you're getting it wrong. And everybody keeps saying that the Republicans all of a sudden have given in on revenues because they changed their position. They're willing to have limits and caps on deductions. Now, if you follow very carefully what the Republicans have been saying, it's they want the rich to pay more in taxes, not by eliminating deductions on the rich. They say get the rich to pay more by eliminating deductions. And Boehner the other day had some arcane plan. He says limit the deductions based on some percentage of your income. I'm not sure what that means, but here's the bottom line. What the Republicans have wanted all during the campaign for the past couple of years, and you can check out Paul Ryan, Romney, and this goes back to Ronald Reagan, they want to either eliminate the income tax with a sales tax, or they call it a fair tax. If they can't get that, what they're really pushing for is a flat tax, and that means everybody pays 20%. Even if you're in a 10% tax bracket, you go up to 20%, the rich 20%, and eliminate all deductions, and that means medical expenses, premiums on health insurance, and as you pointed out, property taxes and state income taxes. So,
Bob, I'm going to leave it there. And, Mara, those are a lot of kind of pure conservative positions, but how close do the real-life negotiations come to any of those things?
Well, I don't think that those are going to be part of the fiscal cliff negotiations, but some of them could be part of the grand bargain negotiations that we'll get next year if we can get over the fiscal cliff. Because the whole idea of this process, as the president tried to explain yesterday, is it's two steps. One, you figure out some kind of basket of revenue hikes, entitlement reform, spending cuts that you can do now, a down payment. And then you set up a process where you tell the tax writing committees next year, we want to do tax reform and entitlement reform. We want to have a grand bargain that really solves our deficits for the next 10 to 20 years. And we're going to give you instructions, find this amount of money from entitlements, you know, find this amount of money from revenues, this amount of money from spending cuts. Here's the ratio of tax hikes to spending cuts that you need. And then at which point you could have a discussion about a lot of these much more fundamental structural tax reform ideas, whether it's a consumption tax, a flatter tax. I mean, those are all things that would come into play when you're talking, when you're having a real tax reform debate, which the president and most leaders in Congress say they want.
Wait, you mean the fiscal cliff negotiations are not the same as the grand bargain negotiations?
No, not really. They're because you can't do tax reform in 2 weeks, which is how much we've got left of this year, a little over 2 weeks before they go away for Christmas. But tax reform, at least in the past, has taken a year and a half to 2 years. Now, the president said the other day that he wanted August 1st of 2013 to be the deadline for getting the grand bargain, the bigger piece, where you do a whole big entitlement slash tax reform legislation. And no, that would take, but that would go through regular order. Those would be committees working, and it wouldn't be a kind of emergency last minute negotiation. It would be, you know, a real congressional process.
And if fiscal cliff isn't scary enough for people in the last 24 hours, everyone's other favorite catchphrase, debt ceiling, has reentered the conversation. Explain this idea that much of the fiscal cliff could be pushed together into next year's debt ceiling negotiation.
Well, the president is saying not over my dead body, but yes, the Republicans have thought, well, if we can't win now in the fiscal cliff negotiations, we still have the debt ceiling, which is a very powerful political weapon. They certainly learned that last year. And we'll say that we won't raise the debt ceiling, which would threaten default on U.S. obligations, unless we get what we want, whether that's spending cuts or entitlement reform. The president is saying, I'm not going to play that game again. We did that last year. It was the first time we ever did it in our history, and we're not going to do it. So you can't link the debt ceiling with the budget negotiations. Now, he put as part of his proposal, a plan that would raise the debt ceiling permanently, give him the power to raise it, and Congress could stop him if they wanted to. But right now, it's up to Congress to raise it.
So to take a step back here, we're exploring the possibility of lumping together the debt ceiling negotiation next year with a fiscal cliff negotiation from this year, which is only here because we failed in the debt ceiling negotiation last year.
Right.
You know those
right.
stairs designed by M.C. Escher that go round
and
round?
Was
he consulting on the negotiating strategy?
Well, every time that they try to tackle these very, very difficult issues, they always put in some kind of a mechanism for what happens if they fail. They keep on failing, and then the mechanism comes up, like the fiscal cliff, which is where we are now. Now they're talking about doing it again. And at some point, somebody explained to me that you're not going to have to design in a kind of fail-safe automatic sequester type thing. The markets are just going to do it for you. The markets have been very patient with the American economy because I guess Europe is so weak. But at some point, interest rates are going to start going up, and the world financial markets are just going to lose patience with the United States political system.
All right, last call. Sarah on Long Island. You're on WNYC with Mara Liasson. Hi.
Hi, good morning, Ann Moore. I've enjoyed you on NPR for years. Thank you for your work.
Thank you very much.
You know, in all fairness and humility, with the Congress, whether it be the Senate or the House of Representatives, it's always us and them. Why hasn't anyone in Congress, in any House, suggested that they somehow adjust their entitlements? They don't ever talk about their entitlements, that they retire with full salary, that they have medical expenses, you know, better than any of us have and for the rest of their lives.
Does it matter, Sarah, that it wouldn't be a drop in the bucket in terms of the national debt?
It's an attitude, because then we would probably be willing to do more. But they just show no sense of anything but their own entitlement while they're pointing their finger at those of us who have any kind of benefit like Social Security or food stamps or any other relief when the time is right for us to have that.
Sarah, thank you.
Yeah, I'm surprised there hasn't been a grassroots movement for that. I mean, there was one a long time ago called term limits, and you could have congressional benefit limits or something, but... Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. And, of course, Congress gets excellent health care.
And I will say it's a very little grassroots movement, but Sarah was not the only caller on our board who wanted to say that. And our China guest the person I met in China who promoted China's authoritarian system is better for the people than our democracy pointed out to me the other day that the approval rating for Congress in America is 11%, which is much lower than the Chinese people's approval for their government, according to the poll. So we do have that attitude toward Congress seeping through. Mara, just give me a quick reaction to something that seems to be breaking today. South Carolina Senator and Tea Party icon Jim DeMint reported leaving the Senate to take over as head of the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation. Is that happening?
Yes, and it sounds like he's been a very, very influential senator among conservative ranks, and now he's going to take a position that has always been very influential, and I'm sure he'll do a lot with it, which is to run the conservative, the intellectual epicenter of the conservative
yes.
movement.
Why would he leave the Senate?
Well, there's a lot of reasons for leaving the Senate. You're in the minority. You're not getting as much done. You think you could, especially if you are a thinker and an ideologue, you think you can have more influence from the outside, and especially running an institution like Heritage.
And maybe the benefits at the Heritage Foundation are better. Who knows?
I'm sure they're not that much better than Congress.
NPR's Mara Liasson, thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, speaking of New Yorkers and New Jerseyans and people in Connecticut who make $250,000 or more, where is the median income in New York City? What neighborhood? I'll bet you cannot guess. Well, new census data reveals it, and we will reveal it to you coming up next with WNYC's own Ilya Meritz and Arun Venugopal. Stay with us.